From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Russian President Vladimir Putin and President Biden have wrapped up their summit in Geneva. It came at the end of Biden's first foreign trip, which included the G7 and NATO. And at that NATO meeting, President Biden repeated his pledge this week to bring all American troops home from Afghanistan by September 11th. That's the 20th anniversary of the attacks that sparked the war. Biden announced that plan 2 months ago, and it would end the longest war in U.S. history. NPR's Tom Bowman covers the Pentagon, and he joins us now for an update on the withdrawal. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Yes, Tom. There were about 2,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan at the time that Biden made that announcement a few months ago. We don't know the exact number today. The military won't say because of security reasons. But what can you tell us about the timeline now?
Well, of course, President Biden said all U.S. troops would be out by September 11th. But it appears most, if not all, troops will be out in July. And you're right, because of security concerns, they aren't saying anything about how many have left. And, of course, there are also some 7,000 NATO troops who will also leave when the Americans do. The sense is that the last American base to close will be Bagram Airfield, north of Kabul. And even at this point, the U.S. military is not really providing any access to bases for reporters there. So, frankly, much of this is really unseen.
What needs to happen logistically? For instance, how much needs to happen for equipment there to come home?
Well, you can imagine a lot of equipment after 20 years. And the experts are saying, you know, it's easy to fly out soldiers, but much more difficult to pack up everything from helicopters to radar dishes to computers. And since Afghanistan is landlocked, you have to fly everything out. And you don't have the luxury you did in Iraq, for example, when you could have a massive convoy heading to ports in Kuwait and load up cargo ships. So the U.S. so far in Afghanistan has loaded up more than, get this, 600 of the massive C-17 cargo planes to move equipment out of Afghanistan. And the Pentagon says they are about 50% of the way done.
Wow. It's kind of hard to wrap your head around those types of numbers when you're talking about that type of equipment. You know, President Biden also said this week that counterterrorism efforts will continue because he doesn't want Afghanistan to be a safe haven for terrorists, of course. But isn't that counterterrorism mission going to be challenging without American troops there?
Oh, absolutely. You really need people on the ground to help with intelligence, with targets. So that will obviously have to fall to the Afghans. And of course, the Afghans are quite skilled, especially the commando force, and they can help. But experts say it will be difficult to do this from somewhere else in the region. They're looking at, you know, perhaps the United Arab Emirates or Qatar. There are some reports that Pakistan would allow its airfields to be used, and that would be helpful, of course, because Pakistan is right next door, but those reports have been shot down. So you'll continue to see a lot of aerial surveillance over Afghanistan, as well as armed drones that could be used to strike Al-Qaeda or ISIS targets. But again, this is going to be very, very difficult to do.
Mm-hmm. Is the Pentagon saying anything else about offering other kinds of support?
Well, the top U.S. officer in the region, General Frank McKenzie, recently said the U.S. would mount only a counterterror mission and not support the Afghan military anymore in its fight with the Taliban. And the general, of course, has civilian bosses, so we can assume those are his orders. Now, that could all change in the weeks ahead if, let's say, Kabul is threatened. You know, you could come to the aid of the Afghan forces. What the Pentagon will say is the Afghans have some 300,000 soldiers and police and should be able to fight back against the Taliban. The Afghans also have a small air force with attack aircraft and helicopters. But once all the American contractors leave, it's going to be difficult to maintain the aircraft because the Afghans rely on civilian contractors for as much as 100% of maintenance. And again, these contractors will be leaving with U.S. troops.
Tom, you've laid all of this out for us really well. You've also been there. What is the realistic view from your point of view on what this means, what this withdrawal means for the future of Afghanistan?
Well, everyone I talk with, either in Afghanistan or in the U.S., everyone agrees the security situation will get worse. But no one can say how bad, not until U.S. forces leave. Then we get a sense of the way ahead. Now, right now, the Taliban are on the move all over the country, grabbing more territory, using targeted killings against government officials, military pilots, and even journalists. Some are telling me a civil war is likely. Others are more optimistic, saying, listen, the Taliban want international recognition and the continued billions of dollars in aid. So, you know, they may not mount, let's say, a massive attack on Kabul. Still others tell you the Taliban don't care about the money. They just want to take over the country. So again, at this point, we'll just have to wait and see what happens. And at this point, nobody can tell you what that country is going to look like after U.S. forces leave.
Tom Bowman covers the Pentagon for NPR. As always, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, the Fed wraps up a big policy meeting today. The central bank is keeping an eye on inflation, a higher cost of buying things, much higher in recent months, while also trying to encourage the economy's recovery from the pandemic recession by keeping interest rates, the cost of borrowing money, low. Lots to talk about with NPR chief economics correspondent Scott Horsley. And Scott, the economy essentially went into hibernation last year. What has the Fed been doing up till now to revive it?
Well, the Fed has been shoveling money into the economy. They've been keeping interest rates near zero, as you say. They've also been aggressively buying government bonds and mortgage-backed securities, basically just trying to keep the financial markets from seizing up and encourage as quick a recovery as we can from that pandemic slump. You know, the Fed has twin goals, which is full employment and stable prices. Right now, they're really prioritizing full employment, getting back to full employment, which we were at before the pandemic, and they're willing to tolerate somewhat higher prices in the meantime.
Right. Well, we have talked about this ballooning inflation, these high prices. The Fed says that's temporary. Does it look like investors agree with them? You know, how are the stock markets doing?
Yeah, I think investors right now are agreeing with the Fed's diagnosis of what's behind that jump in inflation. You know, the Labor Department says prices were up 5% in the 12-month period ending in May. That was the sharpest run-up in prices we've seen in nearly 13 years. But the Fed thinks this is kind of a passing fad. It's, in a way, a sign of an economy that's on the mend as newly vaccinated people start going out and taking advantage of all the services that were off limits for much of the last year. That recovery in demand is happening kind of faster than a lot of people expected and faster than businesses can frankly keep up. And so there is right now a little bit of a mismatch between supply and demand. That's leading to higher prices. But the Fed is pretty sanguine that as employers are able to hire more people and as some of these supply chain bottlenecks get worked out, inflation will settle back down closer to the 2% range that's the Fed's long-term target.
We'll talk about those bottlenecks, the supply in this part of the equation that you're talking about, the supply chain. Price of lumber still high, not as high as it was, but still high. It's hard to get a fence gate, I'll tell you that. new construction projects have been delayed. We hear, you know, if you want to buy a couch, it's going to take a long time. What does this mean for the wider economy?
Well, those are the hiccups that we're talking about. And lumber was actually an early example. When the pandemic first struck, the sawmills kind of shut down. They thought, oh, there's nobody's going to want any lumber. Well, it turned out everybody who was stuck at home decided to rebuild their deck or put up a new fence. So there was a lot of residential demand for, you know, do-it-yourselfers buying lumber. The Home Depot shelves were emptied. And now you've got the professional builders, the home builders that are trying to keep up with the strong demand for housing. The sawmills are starting to catch up. Lumber prices are still much higher than average, but they have come down from their record high in May. We think we're seeing the beginning of supply catching up to demand there, although it's certainly not caught up yet. Of course, the marquee bottleneck that we talked a lot about is the computer chip shortage, which has forced a lot of automakers to dial back production and lots of other kinds of factories that rely on computer chips, whether it's washing machines or other appliances, and of course, you know, laptop makers, computer makers. Again, eventually that'll get worked out. It's not going to happen overnight, but eventually, you know, chip supply will catch up.
What about all the costs, shipping, gas prices?
Yeah, I was talking to a cheese importer on the East Coast just yesterday who told me that his cost of bringing a refrigerated container across the Atlantic has more than doubled since before the pandemic. And what's more, the time it takes to get to make that journey across the Atlantic has roughly doubled and has also gotten way less predictable. So we're seeing lots of challenges there in shipping cargo, both across the Atlantic and certainly across the Pacific, all the stuff we're buying from Asia. Again, that's causing headaches for suppliers, but it's really the side effect of really strong demand and people with money in their pockets and able to spend.
Well, so it sounds like you're saying, though, that the Fed is eyeing all of this and saying this is, you know, a post-pandemic high, this inflation. We think it'll settle out. Does that translate to maybe they won't take any action?
Nobody expects a raise in interest rates today, but people are going to be hanging on Jay Powell's every word to see what, if any, smoke signals he sends about a possible interest rate or dialing back of bond purchases on the horizon.
NPR Chief Economics Correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
President Biden was warmly received by European leaders over the past week during his first trip abroad. But when he comes home, he'll have to confront some harsh political realities on getting his ambitious agenda passed, a scenario reminiscent of former President Obama's first days in office. Let's convene our Wednesday political roundtable with political strategist Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hi, Robin. Happy Wednesday.
Oh, yes, isn't it? And Matt Mikowiak, the Republican. Matt, welcome to you as well.
Hey, great to be with you. Thank you.
And let's start with Biden returning to the U.S., his meeting with EU leaders and President Putin behind him, his infrastructure bill stalled on the road ahead. We're going to get to both. But Jamal, you know, just in this time that we are in, how consequential do you think the next few weeks will be for President Biden? What are you watching for?
Well, yes, it's all consequential because, you know, the clock is running on the Biden administration. They got to get some things done. Trying to get them done this year, this congressional session is important because next year we start to get into the midterms. And so, you know, you're going to see a lot more political chicanery. You know, one of the things that was particularly revealing to me over the last week or so is when Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader, came out and said that he would not confirm a Supreme Court justice in 2024 if the Republicans were back in the majority in the Senate, which just says to me that they're just making it up, right? The Republicans are changing the rules after they confirmed, justices last time while Trump was running for office. They're not going to do it again for a Democrat. So that says to me, to the Democrats, you forget about the rules. Just get what you need to get done. I'm a traditionalist. I'm an institutionalist. I've been around Washington in politics for a long time. It doesn't matter because the Republicans will change the rules when they're in power anyway. So do what it takes to get these infrastructure bills and other problems done now.
Matt, why don't you weigh in on that? Because Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell did vow he'll block another Supreme Court nominee in the run-up to the next presidential election. He had no problem confirming Trump nominee Amy Coney Barrett just before the election last year. Is that something you would recommend to Republicans?
Well, the standard that McConnell reaffirmed is the same standard he used back then, and it's a fundamental either misunderstanding or misconception on Jamal's part. It goes to the question of divided government, and when the American people elect a Senate majority of one party and a White House of a different party, the Senate now minority leader Mitch McConnell has said he will let elections decide it if nominations come in presidential election years. That is what he has said. So that was the same standard he used before when Antonin Scalia died. It's the same standard he has said in the future. It requires the Republicans to take the Senate majority back in the 2022 midterm election. I think Jamal right now would admit that's probably less likely than likely. So we're talking about a scenario that's basically a bank shot scenario. But on the first question of Biden right now, he is over there. He did meet with Putin today. That was a warmer meeting than it should have been, given Biden's recent decision on the Nord Stream pipeline, which made Russia very happy, Germany very happy, and basically the rest of the world, the free world, very unhappy. So we will see what happens going forward. I do think the left is disappointed with what Biden has achieved so far. They got COVID stimulus through. They're moving some bills through the House. There's a very uncertain path through the Senate. It appears the filibuster will hold through the rest of this year and probably through next year. They're nowhere on gun control. They're nowhere on infrastructure. They're nowhere on tax increases. Unless they're going to change the rules, which Jamal appears to dislike changing the rules, except when it benefits his side, they're not going to probably get a lot of these big things done that they want to get done.
Jamal, you want to jump in for a second?
Just very quickly. I mean, Matt's point about McConnell, his statement, I know Matt lives in Texas now, and technical term is that's a load of hooey. McConnell, when it first did this to Merrick Garland, did not mention the separation of parties and which party was in power. He said it was an election year. They changed the rules when it came time for Barrett, and now they're willing to change them again going forward. I just think we all have to be clear about what's happening. The Republicans are making the rules up to use power. They're doing it when it comes to voting. They're doing it when it comes to judges. They're doing it on all these state levels in the state. We've got Democrats need to just do what it takes to get their agenda passed.
Okay, Matt, did you just flush a toilet?
No.
Okay, good. Because I thought maybe there's a commentary there. Look, I want to move forward and take up, Matt, the specifics. Take up a question about the Putin summit. We have the specifics elsewhere in the program, but I'm curious. We know that today Putin praised, after their summit, Biden's morality. He mentioned his professional approach, his experience. Now, Republicans may be stung by what looks there like a diss of Donald Trump. And historically, Republicans have, you know, the position has been that Democrats are, you know, too soft, too conciliatory, too strong men. But Republicans, your party can't do that now, can they, after President Trump embraced Putin? You know, what can Republicans do in this moment?
Yeah, look, and I wish the former President Trump had been more sober about Putin. I think his desire was to try to see if he could increase U.S. leverage and improve U.S. outcomes for policy with Russia if he had a stronger and warmer relationship with President Putin than past presidents have had. That obviously didn't work. That said, I do think the actual record, not the rhetoric, not the Russia's, you know, collusion story, but the actual record for Trump on Russia is stronger than he gets credit for. Putting sanctions on Russia, throwing diplomats out, his absolute moral clarity on Nord Stream 2 and what that will mean for Western Europe and for American interests. You go down the list. Russia did not like the Trump presidency. I don't care what the major media says. They didn't like the policies. They like the policies now better. If Russia likes the U.S. better now, it's because we have a less American, pro-American policy towards Russia. Now, I do think I'm anti-strongman. The Republican Party needs to be clearer about that. I reject that entirely. But we do have to put American interests first. And I don't see Biden doing that as it relates to Russia, as it relates to Nord Stream 2.
Jamal?
Well, one aspect of putting American policy first is to build allies, right? Because I think what President Biden understands is that America is stronger when our transatlantic alliance is in place, when we have alliances around the world that are going to take on some of these strongmen when they come. I think the Trump approach of going alone, America first, is the way that it singles America out, right? And so America ends up being the only person taking stances and then upsetting these coalitions that have been around for decades and were built for a reason. It is a tough thing. I've been in the government. I've been in these negotiations when this is happening. It is a tough thing for Americans to say, we are not just going to do this alone. We are going to do this with friends, and we'll sacrifice 10% of our goals to get 70% of our allies on board. That is a good deal, and I think that that Joe Biden's on the way to that. And I think this agreement today, or this not agreement, but this meeting today with Putin, we will see Biden has reasserted himself as the kind of person who won't be in Putin's pocket.
Well, Jamal, I just have to say, you know, I said, what can Republicans do, given how much Donald Trump embraced Putin, despite, you know, the tons of evidence that he was trying to undermine our democracy. And I see what they might do. Here's Representative Jim Jordan. He's tweeted out, our adversaries feared President Trump. They laugh at President Biden, and every American should be concerned. So that seems to be the message that at least someone's trying to hammer out. But let's move on to what Biden is facing. Top of the list, infrastructure. White House officials say they're going to wait another week or so for senators to come up with that bipartisan deal. Smaller, maybe, but something, you know, that's bipartisan. Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer said starting today, he's laying the groundwork to pass Biden's more ambitious plan without the Republicans on board, no votes, using the budget maneuver. Even though he acknowledged not all Democrats are on board with that. Let's listen.
There are members with very justified views. Whatever you can do bipartisan, we should try. But alongside that is the view that that won't be enough. It won't be enough on climate. It won't be enough on revenues. It won't be enough on some of the human infrastructure, like paid leave and child care and things like that. So we're proceeding on both tracks.
Proceeding on both tracks, but Jamal, we saw that shout out, you know, somebody wants us to be partisan, or bipartisan rather. Politico has brought up these rumors that have apparently swirled in Washington that West Virginia Democrat Joe Manchin may be switching parties. He's the one demanding a bipartisan bill, says he'll hold out. Jamal, how much do you think Schumer is talking to him, and how important would it be for him to stay in this moment in the Democratic Party?
There is nothing more important than Joe Manchin remaining a Democrat for Joe Biden's agenda in the next 2 years. There's nothing more important than that. So the Democrats who say it doesn't matter are people who just, I don't understand the mathematics that they learn and they practice. You've got to get 50 plus the vice president in order to make this work. And so holding on to Joe Manchin is important, which is why doing something from a bipartisan perspective is important. The danger for that is you can do all the easy popular stuff that Republicans like in the bipartisan deal, and then you do all the hard stuff, tax increases and the things that Republicans don't like, which makes it easier for Republicans to attack it. But again, if the choice is keep Joe Manchin on board and get a deal done, that's the option on the table, and Democrats have to pursue it.
And Matt, I'm not going to ask you again, as we've asked every Republican, but you know, why are Republicans voting against what Americans overwhelmingly want, which is infrastructure? Instead, I've got to ask you, in the minute we have, these power plays we've heard about from former President Trump, top aides emailing Justice Department officials, pressuring them to investigate non-existent election fraud, his attorney general secretly seizing phone records of Democratic lawmakers, their families. Is this something you'd advise Republicans to do?
Good question. Look, I would never advise anyone to do anything that's illegal. And if anything has been done that's illegal, it needs to be independently investigated, needs to be criminally charged, needs to be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. I don't care what party
undemocratic?
The person's in.
How about just
pardon
undemocratic?
Me? Oh, of course. Yeah. Well, yeah. Look, I mean, what I would say is there are actual reasonable concerns about the way the election was conducted. Do I believe Biden won? Yes. Do I believe there's any doubt about that? No. Do okay. I believe Pennsylvania violated its own constitution by sending out unsolicited mail ballots? Yes, I do. So I think that's an issue, and I think there are some reasonable questions.
Let you get that in. Matt Mikowiak, the Republican. Jamal Simmons, the Democrat. Thanks to you both.
Thank you. Take care.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
Here in Southern California, it is hot. Really hot. Palm Springs yesterday hit 120 degrees, and firefighters say the state is in for a bad fire season. Scientists now want to better understand how drought affects plants and trees and how they burn. Raquel Maria Dillon of KQED reports on how scientists make precise measurements of vegetation moisture and how they use that info to prevent more damaging fires.
Up here on a hillside above San Jose, it's beautiful and peaceful with a 180-degree panorama of the southern end of the San Francisco Bay. But scientists focused on the details, numbers, and measurements don't see this view. They're staring down a record drought year.
And yeah, the worrying thing up here at Blackberry Hill is you can see, you can tell the plants are struggling.
Alan Houston is a grad student at San Jose University studying meteorology. But today, his task is to snip samples from a particular native plant called chamise as part of a national project to measure vegetation moisture.
We get about 30 grams of each, and we measure how much moisture they've lost to determine how much was in there.
These measurements are collected at more than 100 sites across California, and they go into a national database that helps scientists understand how wildfires burn. Vegetation, or fuel moisture, is one of several factors that determine what's burning and how that influences fire behavior, along with weather and the lay of the land. Researchers started tracking vegetation moisture at this site 8 years ago. This year, fuel moisture levels in the coastal Santa Cruz Mountains are lower than ever before.
Yeah, it was shocking because usually when we go up in April to these sites, it's full of new growth, the plants are growing.
Professor Craig Clements is director of San Jose State's Wildfire Interdisciplinary Research Laboratory, and he supervises the data gathering for this project.
So these plants are designed to go without water for months, but they still are ignitable.
Low moisture is a sign of things to come.
Later in the season, the lower the soil moisture content, the lower the plant moisture content, the easier it is to burn.
Many Northern Californians have noticed. The hills turned golden earlier this year, and the brush looks different on a favorite hike. Even without being scientists or foresters, we can see the effects of low vegetation moisture. It really is drier out there. East Bay Regional Park District Fire Captain Patrick McIntyre took me on a driving tour of a beloved urban park in the hills above Berkeley to show how each different tree species responds to drought conditions.
The health of these giant sequoias is definitely declining. Right there, those are Douglas fir trees.
Many trees here are dropping leaves or bark or have patches of reddish-brown needles. And McIntyre says it's happening all over the San Francisco Bay Area.
The dry brittleness of the brush, it just cracks beneath your feet. Just the visible kind of just sadness of how the trees are looking. Doesn't seem as though there's enough soil moisture just to keep these trees happy and alive right now. It's kind of worrisome.
These symptoms of drought won't go away till it rains in the fall. Those record low vegetation moisture readings aren't likely to get any better either. Firefighters and scientists agree lower vegetation moisture predicts earlier, bigger wildfires this season. The data and the look of the landscape point in the same grim direction. For Here and Now, I'm Raquel Maria Dillon.
It's graduation season, albeit an odd one post-COVID. So many emotions, including for the parents of the child who suddenly veers off the path in the wrong direction, that stomach-clenching feeling they may not graduate. Author Connie Bewald tells one such story in which a single mom is the one clutching her stomach. As one son rebels, the other, the good child, is struggling as well. She just doesn't know that. It's a story that touches on race, fitting in, on the power of truth, keeping a child on the right path while circumstance, the environment, fate, life, the past and present collude to thwart you. That's universal. Then add you're in a new country, holding down your job as a certified nursing assistant in a nursing home. Author Connie Bewald joins us now. And Connie, Kiss Jen gives you a blurb in which she says, this glows with authenticity. It does. A full disclosure, I know the school you write about. This is set in Cambridge, Massachusetts, the high school, hugely diverse. I feel like I know the kids you write about. Where did this come from?
When I started writing this book, it was about the power differential and racism involved in elderly, privileged white people being cared for so often by people of color and what that power dynamic was about. And that's what I started with. Then I started to experience a lot of things with my own high school and college age kids. And they are white and I'm white. They hung out with a lot of kids of color and specifically some Haitian kids. I had already gone to Haiti because Nadine, the character, the CNA at that point, was whispering in my ear intensely, and I wanted to know where she came from. So I went to Haiti, came back, and my younger son was making not the best choices in high school. Mm. And sitting with him in court and such, I mean, there we are in Cambridge where there's a lot of white people, but in that courtroom, I think the day I sat there all day with him, we were the only white people, except for the people who were lawyers and the judge. Mm. I already felt powerless and terrified and didn't sleep for a year. And I just wondered what it would be like to negotiate that as the parents of some of the kids he was hanging out with who, you know, didn't speak English, were working 2 and 3 jobs, and didn't have the privilege and power that I had from being a white person.
You would have written a nonfiction if you wanted to talk more about your son. I hope everything's fine there.
Yes.
Which, you know, we're not going to give away the ending here, but there's such a sense of these wild rides that teenagers can take you on. They can end well, but you have to be there with them. And in your story, you have the Haitian nurse's aide, single mom, Nadine, her 2 sons, Chance, the charismatic senior, off the rails, Henry, the studious college kid on scholarship to an all-white college, feeling like the other. So there's that storyline as well. But you seem pitch perfect in speaking in the way these young men would. Did your son help you with that?
Yeah. Yeah, they both did. I mean, I feel like if you're going to write about people that have a different experience from you, I think you really have to immerse yourself as much as possible in their reality and really try to put yourself in other people's shoes. And my kids certainly helped with that. Going to Haiti really was a lot, too. It was so compelling and interesting, and I started to make these relationships. And then that particular son went back with me the next time.
This is your son.
Yeah, the one who was kind of making the bad choices and still making the bad choices went with me to Haiti because I was like, I don't know what to do.
By the way, you're also a middle school librarian, so a growth education teacher and a mentor.
Yes.
What have you learned, not just through your son, but other young men in particular, about what's going on in that moment in your character? It's, you know, it seems like a lot of things. I can't be as good as my brother. My brother's perfect. I don't know who my father is. There's lots of secrets. What's going on?
Wow. I think a lot. And I think I try to explore it by writing it. I think the whole thing about being tough and tender is really hard. I remember my kids were part of that era of boys wearing their pants really low. And when I asked my kids about it, they said, you know, I said, how do you keep your pants up? And they said, oh, you got to walk big. And that made me start to think a lot about just what that means to walk big and the pressure to walk big and how much pressure there is on boys. In fact, I wrote a little essay that talked about, you know, when it comes time to empty the mouse traps of the mouse bodies, or there are still stereotypical things where perfectly strong feminist women I know still would expect the man, if they have a man in their lives, to do that job.
In other words, you saw in your boys this notion that they had to be tough, be the man. You also borrow from Haitian Creole, from Proverbs, the title, Truth Like Oil.
Truth Like Oil always rises to the surface. And I love Proverbs in any culture. And then had to struggle a little bit with the idea of, you know, now there's a lot of talk about, you know, essentializing cultures, and especially being a white person writing about another culture. I really was scared of risking essentialization.
Well, hold on a second, because I was going to ask you about that. If as a white person, even though you had a son who had these struggles, you know, this idea, did you worry about appropriating? Because not just is your mom character Haitian, many of the characters are Haitian, but you write about the spiritual practices, voodoo, if you will, food. It's their culture. And you just said, what, essentializing. What does that mean? Reducing people to just certain characteristics like their food?
Yeah, it's not a full picture. Reducing a culture to their proverbs and their food, and you focus in on that, and that's all you say. And I believe I've done way more than that in this book. And Truth Like Oil is one of the proverbs that heads one of the sections of the book. And that is a proverb that comes from so many cultures. And I love that. I love that it's so universal.
Yeah. Writer Connie Biewald, her new novel, Truth Like Oil. Thank you so much, Connie. Best of luck with it.
Thank you, Robin.
And to read an excerpt, go to herenow.org. Now we go to Houston for an update. We reported this month on the more than 100 workers at Houston Methodist Hospital who filed a lawsuit saying the hospital's requirement that they get vaccinated against COVID-19 violated their rights. Well, a federal judge recently dismissed that lawsuit in what's being called the first major legal victory for employers requiring COVID vaccines. The workers say they'll press on. Here's Jennifer Bridges, lead plaintiff in the case, reacting to the decision.
We're okay with this decision. We are appealing, and this will be taken all the way to the Supreme Court. This is far from over. This is literally only the beginning.
Bridges and others said the requirement was coercive, experimental, and unsafe, but Judge John Hughes dismissed that. He called the claims false and irrelevant and ruled that Texas only protects employees from being fired for refusing to commit an act carrying criminal penalties. He also took issue with Bridges' contention that the vaccination requirement was akin to medical experimentation during the Holocaust, calling that claim reprehensible. Houston Methodist physician and CEO Mark Boom spoke to Here and Now before the verdict, also blasting the suit.
You know, it's really sad to hear really what sounds like a scraping of internet sites of all of the anti-vaccine rhetoric. The bottom line is that hundreds of millions of these vaccines have been given. I think we've used about 300 million in the United States alone. And we've seen these vaccines to be amazingly safe. The FDA is constantly looking for any signal of any potential negatives. But the bottom line is, humans in the United States have had a 1 in 500 risk over the last year of dying of COVID.
Boom issued a statement after the ruling saying we can now put this behind us and focus on patient care and safety. 99% of Houston Methodist's nearly 26,000 employees willingly complied with the mandate. The rest, that 100, have until June 21st to get their shot or get fired. Meanwhile, Maryland and D.C. have announced they'll be mandating vaccines at all of their hospitals.
You know all that talk about cicadas? Well, if you live in Florida, you are probably thinking about a different bug. Tens of thousands of genetically modified mosquitoes are being hatched in the Florida Keys and released into the wild. It's part of a federally approved experiment meant to control the species. Aedes aegypti is the name of this species, and they can carry diseases like Zika and yellow fever. This is the first ever experiment of its kind in the U.S., and there's both excitement and worry about it. Andrea Leal is executive director of the Florida Keys Mosquitoes Control District. They're working with the British biotech firm Oxitec to conduct this study. And Andrea, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Well, how does this work? How exactly are the mosquitoes genetically modified?
So the mosquitoes are genetically modified to basically kill the female mosquitoes. So one of the big things that is very important to know about any of this technology is that male mosquitoes do not bite. As we're moving forward with this project, we are releasing these genetically modified male mosquitoes into the environment. They will mate with our wild females, and then all of their female offspring then die. So only males survive, again, which do not bite.
Okay, this is fascinating. The idea here is that insecticides don't really work well enough to help in this effort. And you've seen outbreaks of some of these diseases in recent years. Is the ultimate goal to kill off the species entirely?
This particular species is really responsible for 100% of our human mosquito-borne diseases here in the Florida Keys. We saw outbreaks of dengue fever in 2009, 2010 in Key West, and again just last year in 2020 in Key Largo. So we are focusing on getting rid of this particular species. But this project itself is really the first step in a very long process as far as the regulatory authorities are concerned. So it'll be a very long time before we see any sort of elimination, if at all.
Okay. There are concerns, though, from residents. You mentioned that the male offspring don't bite, but that's one of the biggest concerns. Others just don't trust GMO. I mean, around half of American adults distrust genetically modified foods, for instance. How have you addressed those fears?
Trying really hard to explain the difference. You know, we're releasing an organism that is genetically modified, but it's modified to not persist. Whereas if you look at genetically modified foods, that's really, you know, increasing the hardiness of those foods. So it really is two completely different technologies.
What about the concern that you all are basically interfering with the ecosystem, that this is just another attempt by humans to control nature?
Well, this particular mosquito species is an invasive species. So it's not native here to the United States. It's found
right. They've been here since the 17th century, correct?
They did. They believe they came over on slave ships, yes. But as they adapted through time, they're utilizing habitats that are artificial. You know, so we're looking at discarded buckets, bird baths, tarps, boats, which you're not finding natural predators within those. So as you look at that particular species, taking it out of this ecosystem, they really don't play a huge role. And on top of that, they only make up about 4% of our entire mosquito population here in the Florida Keys.
What could this actually mean, though, for animals that eat these mosquitoes?
So it really wouldn't mean anything as far as that particular mosquito species is concerned. As I mentioned, there are very small numbers here in the Florida Keys. Our main mosquito is the salt marsh mosquito. And for other critters that might feed on mosquitoes, that's really the mosquito that they're going to be feeding on.
There's something else I want to ask you about. So Jeffrey Powell, he's an evolutionary biologist at Yale who studies mosquito genetics. He argues that whatever the concerns are, Oxitec's technology does not work. He actually shared data with Time magazine from a 2013 to 2015 Oxitec trial in Brazil, which he says shows the male's effectiveness decreased after about a year and a half because he argues females stopped mating with Oxitec's modified males. What do you say to that?
Well, I know that Dr. Powell did look at Oxitec technology in Brazil. That was their first generation technology. You know, this is a different technology that we're going to be testing here in the Florida Keys, or that we are currently testing here in the Florida Keys. And I know that the EPA has looked at all of that information and has, you know, rigorously vetted all of that prior to approving any trial.
If this works, what do you hope for next?
I really just hope that it's another tool that we can add to the toolbox. Aedes aegypti are very difficult to control. So the more tools that we have, the better we're going to be able to do our job and protect the public.
Andrea Leal is Executive Director of the Florida Keys Mosquito Control District. Andrea, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you, Tanya.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.